Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Psychoanalysis, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. My name is Philip Lance, and I'm a host of the channel. Today, I'm interviewing Robert Grossmark about his book, The Unobtrusive Relational Analyst, published by Routledge in 2018. Robert Grossmark is a psychoanalyst working with individuals, couples, and groups in New York City. He is adjunct clinical professor at the New York University postdoctoral program in psychoanalysis and psychotherapy. He teaches at the National Institute for the Psychotherapies, the clinical psychology doctoral program at the City College of New York, and the Eastern Group Psychotherapy Society. So welcome to the program, Dr. Grossmark.
Thank you so much, Philip. It's a pleasure to be here. And I must say that I am and have been an avid listener to the New Books in Psychoanalysis podcast. And so I'm particularly happy to be here and to be talking to you.
Well, thank you. And yes, we have a growing audience and more people listening. So that's terrific. And so let's begin with our kind of customary question on New Books in Psychoanalysis, which is what brought about the writing of this book?
Yes, well, that is always our beginning question, isn't it, on New Books in Psychoanalysis? I guess I came to this because I was aware, as many people are, that more and more we see patients in our practices and in whatever clinical settings we're working in, who don't seem to be able to utilize exactly the approaches that we have to offer them. And people who seem to be not able to use interpretations and not able to use any reflection on what's going on in the moment. More and more, we're seeing patients who seem to be have real difficulties in the area of self-constancy, of object constancy, people who seem to live in quite different worlds, phenomenologically and psychologically, and who we cannot assume can enter into the kind of verbal interaction and dialogue we might wish for as psychoanalysts. Unfortunately, often these patients have historically been seen as either too concrete or unanalyzable or resistant or assaulting the treatment when they may engage in behaviors that in the past might have been seen as acting out, and they don't get engaged with talking about things in the way that we want. You know, and there's a history there. You know, in the 50s and 60s, Michael Ballant, in writing in the UK, you know, he was a Hungarian immigrant to the UK, was had a similar comment that was the inspiration for his book, The Basic Fault. He noticed that patients at that time were not able to use the customary analytic technique of the time, which was very what now I guess we would call a classical technique, relying almost entirely on interpretation. And he noticed that for those kind of patients, they couldn't utilize language. They were regressed patients, and language, rather than its meaning, really, words were objects rather than meaningful communication. And patients like that seemed to require a different register of psychoanalytic engagement.
Let me stop you there so we can go deeper into this area of patients that can't be reached. You know, really kind of ironically, I just finished 10 minutes ago with a patient who's actually the opposite of the kind of patient I think you're talking about. He came in with really clear symptoms around a hostility, aggression, and some very kind of dramatic sort of sexual symptoms. And within two sessions, it all crystallized for me, sort of a very simple Freudian interpretation about some compromise formations having to do with yearnings for a father who had left him the family under traumatic circumstances when he was 10. But in any case, my point is we do sometimes get these other kind of patients where it seems like we are able, I have to admit, it doesn't happen with me very often, but this one happened to be a really easy one to do some immediate interpretive work. But you're talking about obviously a very different kind of patient.
Well, perhaps, and I think certainly what I'm offering, and as I describe it, is an addition, right, and not something that's in any way, a replacement for anything. And certainly, you have a patient who's engaged on that level very quickly, and we'll see. Yeah. Well, I guess we'll see where that goes. Also, I'm interested in patients who have, in many ways, quite advanced verbal capacities and intellectual capacities or very effective capacities in that area and have developed lives. I mean, I certainly see patients who have career successes, relationships, perhaps, have developed families, in many ways, parts of life have developed in a way that looks adaptive and competent. And there are still areas within that have been partitioned off or sequestered inside that are that have quite undeveloped aspects. And so that one can find people who have these very developed areas, but in their private life or in some kind of sexual area, they are struggling with phenomena of disorganization and depersonalization. And some very, as one listens and allows people to bring in all of who they are, one can often find areas of what we used to call regressed areas, but certainly areas of diffusion and disconnection where things are not quite as they seem. And where there is some functioning of an alternative kind of reality.
So is that what I have a line from your book? Areas of the self that are much less likely to be reached by dialogic engagement. So it sounds like that's what you're talking about. But couldn't we just think of that's the unconscious that as psychoanalysts we're always trying to bring into dialogic engagement eventually?
Right. So that's a nice, that's a good segue. It's because I think that these areas, typically one of the things that would define them is areas that are not available to be put into words. Within psychoanalysis currently, there's been a great deal of interest in the area that's not symbolized. And within a more classical tradition, we have the interest in unrepresented states. There's a wonderful book by Levine et al., where there's a number of chapters from European and American analysts working off of the work of Andre Green, where they're really interested in states that have no representation and symbolization, and they're asking the question of how we reach and engage with these kind of states. In the more relational interpersonal world, we have the groundbreaking work of Donald Stern, who some years ago introduced the term unformulated experience. But there are areas that have yet to have form, yet to have shape. And he asks the nice question, I'm not going to get this quite right, of, how do we look for what we don't know is there to be looked for? I think I got that totally wrong, but you get the gist. And Christopher Bolus has been writing about the unthought known. And in the world of Bion, certainly, and the Bionians were certainly interested in building the mind, in areas of the mind that, in Bion's language, the psychotic part of the personality, but areas where thoughts do not take shape as thoughts and are yet to have form. In Bion's language, those are areas dominated by beta elements and where there has been less than adequate alpha function to actually make, not only make words, but make the experience, which is why for many patients, not all obviously, but for many patients asking how do you feel is a very complicated question. And for many patients, and I'm still in the way answering your initial question of how I came to write the book, is that I've been looking for a way to engage patients in an analytic process that takes account of and works with these areas where people are not, because these are states that are unrepresented and sensations, if you will, that have yet to come together as actual experience, and certainly are not available to be talked about. And so I think that as Balland was picking up in the 60s, you know, working with interpretation and asking people to use reflective functioning, sometimes may be way ahead of a patient who's in the areas that we want to get to, there is no reflective functioning, or it's a reflective function that is perverse. And likewise, a more contemporary interpersonal and relational treatment that asks the patient to consider what effect he or she might be having on the analyst's mind, or to offer aspects of our experience of the patient, may also be so many steps ahead. In other words, speaking to the part of them that can cognize and can pull things together in words. And when we do that, we are maybe inadvertently shaming or pushing underground the parts that are calling out to be attended to and touched and known, that have no form and are yet to have words. And so that's why one of the gists of the book is that where much mental health treatment, and certainly much psychoanalytic treatment, has been so oriented to trying to bring people out of their areas of disorganization and damage, and into consensual reality, and into to try and bring them into areas, if you want to use an older language, of greater ego functioning. And I have the second part of the title, by the way, the book is called The Unobtrusive Relational Analyst: Explorations in Psychoanalytic Companioning. And that's an idea that rather than bringing people out of their areas of pain and disorganization, we might lend ourselves to being drawn into their worlds, to companion them in the register. It's often an issue of register and idiom, to allow ourselves to be drawn into their world rather than seeking to draw them out of their world into ours. And in my experience, and what I try and relate in the book, this leads us into some just interesting, as it were, altered states and altered dimensions of human interaction in our work. And why it's called, if I can go on, Philip.
Let's slow down a little bit, just because I want to ask a couple questions or one question. So I heard Balland, I heard Bion, and then I heard some relational authors. I think you mentioned Donnell Stern. I first came across your work in a book, De-idealizing Relational Theory, which is a collection of chapters. And I remember as I read your chapter, I thought, oh, he's an object relations guy. Oh, he's integrating object relations and relational. But how would you place yourself in that landscape?
Well, it's a nice question. And I chuckle. I've had some interesting events around this. You know, a few years ago, I had a case that I presented at, I think it was Division 39 conference, and Sheldon Bach and Philip Bromberg were the discussants of the case, and it was then published in Psychoanalytic Dialogues, and I thought that I was working relationally, and I got a call from some people who were putting together a psychoanalytic casebook where each psychoanalytic approach would be represented by a case, and they wanted to use my case because it represented Freudian analysis.
Uh-huh.
So, which is to say, these things are interesting and fluid, and I think in a very healthy way are in motion. I'm very interested, obviously, by object relations thinking, and if you want a Venn diagram of how these theories sit, where I'm sitting right now, I think is on the I'm in the relational faculty at NYU postdoc, and most of my papers have come out in dialogues and contemporary psychoanalysis. But in that Venn diagram, I think I'm in that area where relational overlaps with object relations and contemporary Freudian, and there's some self-psychology in there and a strong influence of Winnicott. I would say that the piece of object relations that I carry with me and treasure is the idea of entering into the internal world. And that it seems to me one of the major coordinates of how I'm engaging with patients and conceiving of what's going on. The reason it's the unobtrusive relational analyst, I think I want to address that, I was looking for a way to square a circle in a way, to bring together how do we stay out of the way of a patient's full expression of who they are, and to stay out of the way of the full expression of the unconscious, given that much of that may not come in words, it may come in different dimensions. But at the same time, how to not get trapped in a kind of what I always experienced, there's a kind of straitjacket of neutrality or abstinence. So how is one present and in one's own subjectivity, and at the same time, staying out of the way and valuing that things that come from the patient's mind and inner world are really where it's at, as Symington writes about how it's the patient's life, not ours. And I really do think that we want the treatment to be totally the patient's and to be conducted in the patient's idiom and register, if that makes sense. I've gone a little away from the question about object relations, but it's the valuing that the patient's internal world will be expressed if one allows and invites that total expression.
Well, I'm glad I heard Winnicott's name crept in there, because I don't remember right now if there was a lot about Winnicott in the book, and you do a terrific job of integrating so much great literature. It was really a pleasure seeing how you brought in so many different perspectives and brought them together. But in some ways, it sounds like you're very much with Winnicott, who didn't at the end of his life, he say some things about he regrets all the interpretations he'd made to his clients, because he really valued this holding environment for the patient who may not have entered into the world of the mother being a separate object, the idea that people are infants sometimes are still living within the world of the environmental mother. She's not yet a separate object. And so it seems like Winnicott is sort of a inspiration for your work.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And just what you said, and to borrow some of Winnicott's language, for patients who have yet to develop and achieve unit status and who are going to relate to the analyst as an environmental mother, patients who are going to take the analyst for granted, and they need to. The object in the chapter about psychoanalytic companioning, I build a lot on his fantastic paper from 1945, which really tells you something, not only because it's so long ago, but that is, the Second World War and many other distractions. And he was writing a paper called Primitive Emotional Experience, and he talks about how the infant takes the mother for granted, mm-hmm. and that she doesn't exist outside of the infant's needs, and she appears when needed, and she disappears when not needed. And it's thinking like that, that has greatly informed me, and I feel that when to engage with those aspects of a patient's mind, one wants to be able to lend oneself fully to that kind of experience and not fight it. I mean, that's, I think, the thing, to not precipitously try and bring patients out of those kind of zones, because I think when we do that, we abandon the patient, and and often those zones are full of a kind of inner and private pain and desperation, which is not formulated. It is just a sensation of pain, I think. And if we are quick to go into talking about things rather than or trying to have the patient regard us as a whole object, we will abandon them and perhaps greatly shame them. And I think I found just some very rich and healthy work as I've allowed myself to be engaged in those kind of registers with patients.
Maybe,
it's been exciting.
Maybe you could give an example, because I'm imagining this kind of unobtrusive work where the patient could go on for perhaps months, years without the analyst ever really maybe making much in terms of interpretations, or and who's just kind of there. How long can this go on? And doesn't ultimately something have to be said, you know, about what's going on, or, you know?
Well, I think, you know, things can be said, and I think I'd be, I do want to say that unobtrusive, and there's a lot I can say about the idea of being unobtrusive, but it doesn't mean simply, although sometimes it can mean, being really moderating one's verbal interactions and being allowing the patient that kind of space and quiet within which they can come to themselves. And sometimes being unobtrusive can be actually quite active and vocal, because one is unobtrusive to the full expression of the patient's idiom, to borrow from Bowles, and one wants to be unobtrusive to the developmental needs of the patient, meaning when the patient has a developmental need to be in a more regressed relationship to you, which might actually involve asking you for concrete advice, for instance, to not be obtrusive to that and say, well, we don't do that, this is psychoanalysis, and to be unobtrusive to the developmental and emerging field. There's too much to say about this to fit into our time, but I think when people come together and patient and analyst come together, something emerges that is greater than the sum of their two parts and often involves a fascinating narrative, if you will, a telling of parts of the self and of the patient's pre-experience that have yet to have form. Now, the interesting thing about this is that you know, these patients show they don't tell, but that showing is not just an individual act. What we find, and this is where enactment is involved, these aspects of a patient's mind and a patient's being really find expression, because they're not going to find expression in words. It's very rare that a patient comes in and says, I have no self and object constancy. Can you help me, doctor? But that kind of thing is going to find expression in what we would call the enactive dimension of the treatment. It's going to be in the emerging and living through of experience and happenings, in phenomenological happenings between the patient and the analyst, so that one finds oneself living out strange experiences with the patient, which seem to be calls from this part of them. I'd love to give you an example, but I did want to put these a couple of pieces in first that will help hopefully make sense of things, so that because if we're looking at unrepresented, unformulated states, we're not going to find them by asking about them or by asking the more developed part of the self. They emerge unbidden in the field of treatment. And as you know, there's lots that's been written about the field, coming from the South Americans, the Barangers or Baranger, and certainly Ferro, Civitaresi, and so on have had a real interest in the field. But also the relational and interpersonal people have had a lot to say about the field. Can I add also that I am a group analyst. I do group work, and the people in the group world have known for decades that when people come together in a group, there is an emergence of a phenomenon of the group as a whole, that is greater than a simple addition of the sum of the parts, that there is an emergent phenomena. So I am interested, that's the field in two lines, completely inadequate explanation, but I am interested to be unobtrusive to and let the field, which involves the analyst and the patient and all of their unconscious function, obviously, and that we find ourselves living through some fascinating experiences that have yet to have form. I mean, I'll give you I'm dying to give you an example, but I have one more piece to put in. So I'm always interested in what the patient and the field are saying, meaning I've taken seriously an idea that comes from Christopher Bowles, which is that there is a drive to represent the self. And I think that's really a key for me. And more I find myself thinking about it, that there, people are trying to find a form of representation of the self. And interestingly, he breaks it down that there's self-representation in words, but there's also self-presentation, which comes in actions. And I don't, so I'm much less likely to see things as acting out. I'm much more likely to see people trying to represent themselves in a register, in a, if you like, a language that is bodily and somatic. So in paying attention to the field, I have the idea that this representation of what is yet to have form takes place with an other and involves the other, which would be the analyst, and that together we find ourselves living through, and this is a phrase used by Winnicott and by Betty Joseph, we find ourselves living through parts of the patient's early experience that have yet to be experienced really, or suffered, or we find ourselves living through elements of the patient's mind. Your question, I haven't forgotten your question. For an unobtrusive analyst, I say a lot, don't I? Your question about won't there be words ultimately? Well, of course there are words, and there are words all along the way as needed. But primarily in these areas, words come after a sense of being known. And I think that a major piece here is that these are patients who've never been known, never had someone resonate, register, recognize, and know them for who they are inside. And of course, that misrecognition and lack of being known has had tremendous impact on them. And one is known not only by someone saying, I see you, I know you now, and I know this about you, which is also, which is certainly what one sometimes, what is sometimes the sum of what we're saying, but also in action. Look, I'll give you just a simple example. This is not a case example, but just a little example. You know, a patient who doesn't show for sessions and is absent. This goes on for a period of time. And I sit with an uncomfortable feeling, as many people would, a feeling of what's going on. Has this person dropped out? The patient does maintain contact. We'll often communicate a text or a call in between sessions. But there's a period of time where I don't see the patient and I feel a sense of dread and I feel a sense of, if you will, goneness. I'm very aware in the time that the patient isn't there that he's gone. And I feel it viscerally. It turns out that the patient was coming to my office and standing outside and finding himself unable to push the door button, the doorbell, and to come in. So to say that the patient was resisting or wasn't there sort of misses the point. I would, and I understand it, as the patient very much being there. And, you know, Sheldon Bach and Neville Symington talk about our patients don't actually have to be in the room to be in treatment. It's a very useful notion and helps a lot with these kind of situations. But the patient, with no awareness at all, had conveyed in action, in the enacted dimension, an experience of profound absence, loss, and goneness. And, you know, it transpired that this is a patient who had spent much time waiting for parents who didn't show on time, who would be neglected and left, not only physically, but left emotionally. And these experiences were yet to really be clear in the patient's mind. The patient not only hadn't quite represented that as experience, but really hadn't developed feelings around that, but was riddled with many symptoms of disorientation and kind of being lost as he would go around his day. So that would be a very simple example. Like, I could go on and on about the case, but I would say where one is looking rather than see what the patient isn't doing, as in, well, they weren't at the session and it is a resistance to a process, but there's actually a desperate cry from a part of the patient that has never been known, who is crying to be seen and known. And isn't it interesting that that experience came in action, and it came through my experience of the absence, which was in a way painful for me and created anxiety and so forth. As I say that, hopefully that sounds comprehensible, but also not that complicated. Yeah. Once you sort of do a kind of a figure ground shift that a patient is showing rather than not.
Yeah. Well, okay, so this then starts raising questions in my mind about the frame, your emphasis on unobtrusively allowing patients to show in session or out of session, to enact, because we often begin to get pushed around the frame. For instance, a patient who brings me breakfast and sometimes lunch and wants me to eat in session with them, or the patient who wanted to leave his luggage in the waiting room for half a day. And if I'm unobtrusive, so how do you handle issues where you really have to begin thinking about sticking to a more classical traditional approach of not sort of maintaining sort of strong boundaries?
You know, it's an important question, and it's one when I present, I'm always asked, can I come at it this way? That there's a great paper by Neville Symington called The Essence of Psychoanalysis, and he talks about the difficulty when one gets confused about what is primary and what is secondary. And he writes about what is primary is psychoanalysis, which means the internal work of internal change, the transformation of the inner world. And what is secondary is the format, is the way that we get there. And he writes about the many meetings of the International where he would find incredibly uninspiring when people would debate whether three times a week was psychoanalysis, but four times a week definitely was, and two times a week, well, that's not really psychoanalysis. And he uses it to say, look, we can so easily get caught on what he calls, borrowing from Immanuel Kant, we can get caught on the phenomena and lose touch with the noumena, which is the thing itself. And the thing itself of psychoanalysis, I believe, is this profound representation and transformation of the self in a way that the patient can use, utilize, and do themselves. So that's a kind of coordinate as I think about your question about boundaries. And to go to that, I think I welcome people who are expressing, and look, there are cases in the book, which I suppose some people more classically trained might chafe a bit by some of what happens. But as one patient, the patient Kyle from the first chapter, said to me, look, this is me. There's no other way I can do this. And I think that needs to be listened to. You know, when a patient drops off their luggage or their bags in your office and comes back later, that's a profound utilization of the object in a nonverbal, unrepresentative form. And I think if you start shutting down, well, we don't do that because we do psychoanalysis. I think you're speaking from phenomenal rather than noumenal consciousness, if you get what I mean. And I think that we want to invite all the registers that a person can use. And I think it's really important. There's a great paper by LeCour and Bouchard called The Dimensions of Mentalization from the International Journal. And in it, they're French analysts, and they talk about different dimensions of mentalization. And of course, there's the level which is symbolized, but they also talk about motoric and non-symbolized mentalization. And I think this is really important, because if we want to really reach the unconscious, and if we have the idea that there is certainly, and you mentioned it earlier with your patient, the unconscious of repression and conflict, but we want to reach other parts of the unconscious. And Freud was very aware of this. I start the book with a quotation from Freud where he talks about many different types of consciousness, only some of which his work has addressed. So I really take that seriously. So patients are inviting us into these different areas of consciousness when they bring food into the session. The issue of boundaries, I should say, there's obviously some important things to say in the realm of the real, which is you can only work if you are comfortable within yourself, because the most important boundary and the most important container and holding of the treatment is the analyst's mind. So we can only work comfortably if we can hold and then digest, contain what is being given to us. But in my cases, the actual boundary of the treatment in terms of, you know, when the session takes place, whether or not the person is there, in some instances, they're kind of rare, but I mentioned them. But also payment. I'm someone who works in private practice, so that the structure is such that I feel I can do this work. So that, you know, I give you the example of the patient who wasn't physically in the room talking, but he was absolutely deeply in the analysis. Now, I don't know enough about your cases to know how one might experience someone dropping off their baggage, which now that I hear myself say that, is beautiful, because right, you hear it, right?
That person, what do you say? No, you can't leave your baggage with me.
Right, and that would be on would say, well, look, of course, we something needs to be deposited in your mind, and it needs to reside there for a while until they're ready to metabolize it, and you would want to metabolize that experience. And that makes a point I want to make, which is that often patients who have been derided in psychoanalysis as not analytic, because they only want to talk concretely about the events of the day or what he said and she said, and they're not being insightful. They do things which have been called acting out, which is always a pejorative term. I mean, I even if one doesn't want it to be, it is. But those patients often are the patients who are most deeply in a psychoanalytic process. And I think that because they are in a regressed transference where they want you to, that's wonderful, Philip, thanks for that, where they want you to literally concrete, see, they're in the concrete motoric dimension of mentalization. They want you to hold their baggage. That's a very, very powerful psychoanalytic occurrence. To say that that's, you know, acting out of some sort, and also to try and talk about it quickly. What does this mean? What do you think that means? Or to introduce the idea of I felt burdened, or maybe I felt, is to bring it to a different developmental level, which would utterly suffocate the very level that is being expressed by this patient, who I'm now feeling very warm towards as I'm speaking.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That's clear.
Yeah, it's still, and I don't want you to answer this, but I mean, it still leaves me with having to make it, let's say this is near the end of the session. do I say yes or do I say no? Ultimately, so sometimes you don't, but I realize we don't know enough about this patient and this particular situation.
Right. I can't say, but generally I can say a general thing, which may or may not fit with your case, of course. But, you know, generally my interest is to lend my mind and myself to be available for all these different dimensions of communication and representation. And therefore, when someone does that, I'm most likely to roll with it. And this gets into the chapter, The Flow of Inactive Engagement. I'm likely to think, here comes a communication and an invitation, a call into another dimension of this patient's functioning that they can't tell me in words. So not only am I more likely, depending on reality and logistics and what I'm comfortable with, obviously, and what can, you know, what can fit in my office, right? But I'm more likely to roll with it and to see what begins to arise, to respect the unconscious. I think that is so important to say, because I think we cannot contrive or dictate the representations of the unconscious. And I want to wait and see how that's going to feel and what is going to be the emergence, inactive dimension, because people, you know, it's, and I in the book, hopefully some of the people listening will be interested to read the book, and you'll see some just really interesting stories where I end up in territory that I could not have imagined and absolutely have not formulated about a particular case, but found myself in Winnicott and Betty Joseph's words, living through an experience and living through a dimension, which ultimately, you see, and this speaks to the therapeutic action here. I think this living through and this being known in the dimension that is asking to be heard and reverberated with is really healing, and healing in a way that sometimes words are not going to reach.
So that you're answering my penultimate question. I have one more after this, but yeah, in terms of therapeutic change, you know,
yes.
There's kind of a debate. Some people said, well, it's insight, which, and others, no, it's more of the relationship, the corrective, maybe emotional experience with the therapist. But you're kind of, are you saying one of those, or you talked about living through with the patient something?
Yeah. I make a lot of Winnicott's use of paradox, and I very much, which is evident in the title, of being unobtrusive and relational, right? I think we can be more than one thing at once, right? And I think that in terms of therapeutic action, insight comes in many different dimensions. And I think, you know, insight has been wrapped in something that is, wrapped in some very smart psychoanalytic thought. But I think that insight often comes in the experiential dimension. I wouldn't say that my resonance with the patient's expression of absence, and we did talk about it in that instance, so there was a processing. But I think that to think that insight has to be something that is well spelled out, narrows our idea of not only the unconscious, but of what human beings are capable of when they come together. I try not to get caught in, you know, is it going to be insight or is it the relationship? Because from where I'm sitting, they're not necessarily separate things. I think that it is what I find is that when you do join people's register, that people come together more with a sense of wholeness and integration, and along with that, comes the development of reflective functioning. And you do find people gradually with more and more curiosity. You can't be curious about your mind if you've yet to really experience yourself as located in your mind. And that comes along, and that comes along, and one can end up, you know, with talking at great length about how a particular patient's mind works and so forth. That's not an avoidant answer. I believe that quite seriously, that we need to respect the depth of human functioning.
Yeah. You know, I really appreciate this book because it talks about a way that I feel like I and probably many psychotherapists and analysts are kind of working in this area you're talking about, but don't know that they are and haven't gotten the language and the theory that you present in your book that helps us understand why I think a lot of us naturally gravitate toward the kind of work you're talking about. But then you help us understand better what we're doing, why we're doing it, and in some sense reinforcing it. And as a candidate at an institute, I've always got this sort of super ego of my instructors in the institute saying, you know, you need to be making the transference interpretations, or you need to be making the conscious in this more kind of older school way. And you're an antidote to that.
Yeah, I have in my mind a wonderful line from Thomas Ogden's paper on holding and containing, where he's coming from a Bionian Winnicottian perspective, and he talks about how the classical idea of making the unconscious conscious, but really what Bion and Winnicott are talking about is making the conscious unconscious, so that, in his language, we don't have time to get into it, so that the work of waking dreaming can proceed uninterrupted. I have an empathy for the parts of the person who are yet to have representation and are calling out in these other dimensions. You mentioned that the about how people respond to my book, and indeed, that's exactly it. I think it's many people have said, you put into words something that I kind of knew, but it's kind of an unthought known. Like I think just like, if you will, a good interpretation. I was taught in my doctoral training by I.H. Paul, the late and wonderful I.H. Paul, at the City University doctoral program, among other wonderful teachers, I should say. And, he would say, how do you know an interpretation has worked? Well, and he was a classical analyst. It's not when people go, oh, wow, I never thought of that. But it's when you get a sense of, a kind of, yeah, I knew that. I had never quite put that together. And I think that makes me happy when people respond to my book like that. Alongside, I think, an idea that I am trying to open up something that is relatively, that is a bit new in the idea that we want to work in these other dimensions and take them for what they are and engage with them on their own terms.
Well, in 1 minute or less, are you working on another book, or has this book made you not want to do another book?
Oh, my goodness, quite the opposite. Okay. I'm energized, and I have too many writing projects going, and I'm not sure how it will coalesce into a book. I'm currently interested in what I'm calling psychotic shame, but that's a whole other story.
Okay.
we don't have time, and I'm sorry I didn't get to really talk about a case. All I can say to the listeners is take a look at the book, which the cases are extensive, and hopefully really illustrate the ideas that we've been talking about.
Well, thank you very much, Robert, for contributing this book to us.
Well, and thank you, Philip, for the invitation and for such a welcoming and unobtrusive interview.
Yeah, you're very welcome. You've been listening to an interview with Dr. Robert Grossmark about his book, The Unobtrusive Relational Analyst, Explorations in Psychoanalytic Companioning. Here at the New Books in Psychoanalysis podcast, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. Check out our website and feel free to email me with your comments and questions. Thanks for listening.